Shrink Wrap Radio number 294, The Dark Side of Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, with Stephen Soltz.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychoanalyst, ardent political activist, and past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, Dr. Stephen Soltz of the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. We'll be discussing a critique that he recently co-authored on the dark side of Dr. Martin Seligman's Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program. You can find out more about Dr. Soltz's background by visiting our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Stephen Soltz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. I should say it's good to have you on again, because we spoke briefly in person back in the 2007 at the 115th APA conference in San Francisco, where I interviewed you and Steve Reisner briefly about the role of psychology in military interrogation. And at that time, it was in relation to our involvement in Iraq. So I don't know if you remember that interview or not.
Oh, yes.
I do. It was in the food court, as I recall, near the conference.
Yes, I remember that food court and the interview well.
Great. So you recently popped back up on my radar as a result of an article that you co-authored on the progressive blog Truth Out. And your article is titled The Dark Side of Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. But before we get into that, to give us a bit more context, what can you tell us about Truth Out? I wasn't previously familiar with that online publication.
First, I should just say it appeared on a number of online sites. Counterpunch, Truth Out, Op-Ed News, etc. And then a briefer version was actually published in The American Psychologist, where the original articles that we were critiquing had appeared.
Oh, good.
Along with several other commentaries.
Oh, good. Well, I'm not surprised to hear that it got picked up, and I'm glad to hear that you also published it in The American Psychologist. We'll get to that later.
So Truth Out is one of a number. It's one of the major sort of progressive news sites on the web. They reprint a certain percentage of articles from elsewhere and have some investigative reporting and commentary of their own. As I say, they're one of the preeminent of these.
Yes, as I looked at their site, I saw actually they have a large staff. So whereas, usually one thinks of a blog as being maybe one or two people, this really looks like a news reporting organization.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a blog. My sense of blog, it's not a blog, but who knows where the boundaries are.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what to call it. But at any rate, give us some background on what we're going to be discussing, which is the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program.
Yeah, Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, or CSF, is a major initiative in the Army that was started a couple of years ago that's intended to increase the resilience of soldiers, partially to make them less likely to suffer from PTSD, and partly to create an invulnerable army, the most effective army on earth, as has been said elsewhere. It's based on psychological principles from so-called positive psychology, developed by Martin Seligman and lots of other people over the last couple of decades.
Well, I actually had a chance to hear him speak about this because I attended, I think it was the second annual worldwide conference on positive psychology held in Philadelphia this past summer. And I've not only encountered it in his writing, but heard him talk about it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And I believe he got like a huge amount of money.
Penn got where he is, University of Pennsylvania. His lab got $31 million.
In your article, it says that the whole program is a $125 million initiative.
Yeah.
But Penn didn't get all of that money.
No, they got the $31 million to do the development and train the initial training.
Okay.
The training of trainers model. So they're training staff sergeants who are supposed to be these master resilience specialists.
Yes. Living. Okay. Well, your article was written as a reaction to an issue of the American Psychologist, which is the kind of the preeminent magazine that comes out of the American Psychological Association. And they had a whole issue that was devoted entirely to 13 articles that detail and celebrate the virtues of a new U.S. Army/APA collaboration. Just overall, because we're going to drill down on this, but in general, what were your objections to that issue of the American Psychologist?
Well, I found it rather outrageous that the APA was publishing an issue. And, you know, the American Psychologist is a supposedly a peer-reviewed journal. Getting published there is a very high-status activity. And this special issue was edited by Dr. Seligman and another, and was basically puff pieces on the CSF, the Combat Soldier Fitness and CSF program. There was absolutely no critique there. You'd think if you wanted a balanced view, you would have included a few key authors who would have raised questions about its empirical basis, about some of the perhaps complex ethical issues that we feel are involved there, but none of this. It was completely absent, and we thought it was outrageous that the APA put its imprimatur. This is a journal that's edited by the CEO of the APA, Norm Anderson. You know, it's not got an independent editor. It's, you know, an official journal of the APA in a way that no other journal is. And so this was basically putting their imprimatur on this military initiative and basically bragging about it.
Yeah, you and your co-authors don't mince words. You say the APA itself has adopted a jingoistic cheerleading stance toward a research project about which many crucial questions should be posed. So it was a hard-hitting article. Isn't making soldiers more resistant to PTSD a good thing?
Well, that's a complex question. No one wants soldiers to suffer PTSD. And we should always keep in mind that the most effective prevention of PTSD is not to send them into wars in the first place. So that has to always be kept in mind. And to leave that out of the equation is to leave out a large part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, preventing PTSD is important. And efforts that can prepare soldiers for combat and to not suffer from PTSD are important. But it's also important what those efforts are. Part of the problem is that this is a very biased program that views it from only one angle. Basically, PTSD is viewed as a weakness of the individual soldier that needs to be remedied, and use positive psychology to make the soldiers stronger, more resilient, so that they won't break down. But it ignores a large part of what we know about PTSD, which is that PTSD is often, some think always, but at least often, a moral disorder that involves complex reactions not just to what happens to one, to the, a trauma in the sense of, you know, a bomb hitting, but reactions to what one does. Sometimes, and unfortunately, more often than one might think, it involves reactions to actions that one performed that one would strongly wish one didn't. For example, killing civilians in ambiguous situations at checkpoints has happened so often in those first few years in Iraq because of the woeful underpreparing of the military. If one wanted to prevent the PTSD from that, the command should have taken far greater steps to prevent those needless killings.
Yes.
But it didn't occur for a number of years. So, but CSF totally leaves that out and focuses only on this, on the apparent weakness of the individual who, upon killing an innocent family at a roadblock, might be traumatized. And instead, they should become more resilient for these actions.
Yes, and we'll go into that some more. Just to be fair to you and your co-authors, I should mention that you do acknowledge the valuable role that talented and dedicated psychologists play in the military and the importance of our providing soldiers and veterans with the best care possible.
Most definitely.
Yeah. So one of your objections is that CSF is presented as a training program, but that in fact it's an enormous research project on something like a million soldiers. Tell us about that. Why is that a problem?
Well, it's interesting. This was first called to my attention by a member of an IRB. IRBs are the institutional review boards that have to judge research projects in terms of their ethics, and all research is supposed to be approved by IRBs. And a member of an IRB who is very familiar with the military and military research, you know, in no sense anti-military, called me up a couple of years ago and started saying, what is this program? This sure looks like a research project. Did it go through IRB approval? And that sensitized me. It had been on my back radar, and it raised it to the front of the radar. Indeed, this is a research project that it's never been done before. It's based on research done by the Penn Group, and I assume we'll talk about that in a little bit, which is then blown up in terms of its significance and turned into this major project that all soldiers are going to be required to go through, and who knows if it works.
Okay.
But the soldiers are not given the right, as research ethics requires, the right of informed consent to say, no, this isn't for me.
That's right. And the APA ethical guidelines on the rights of human subjects require consent, informed consent, isn't that right?
Well, actually, that's not right, because
okay.
In 2002, they changed the ethical guidelines to not require informed consent in circumstances where government or institutional authority say that it can be dispensed with.
Oh, that's interesting.
And we suspect that this was due to military and intelligence influences.
That does sound a little alarming that it can be waived,
you know,
by the government.
So, exactly, it says that informed consent can be suspended, quote, or otherwise permitted by law or federal or institutional regulations. That, imagine how broad that is.
Yes.
Almost any institution, if my university says you don't need informed consent, then according to the APA, I don't need informed consent. It had any institution. My personal suspicion is it had to be written that way because I think they had the CIA in mind, and they wanted to make sure that one didn't know that, that it wasn't clear. But I can't prove that at this point.
Well, given that there's new language around that you're telling us about, then is there, in fact, a violation of the guidelines?
Well, not of the APA guidelines, but the federal government's guidelines on research require the so-called common rule, which is adopted by 21 federal agencies, requires informed consent, IRB approval, and informed consent for anything, but there are certain types of exempt categories, which is clearly, if one were to say it's research, it's clearly not among the exempt categories. The Department of Defense does adopt the common rule.
Now,
so therefore, they are bound by this. If they admit that it's research, they're bound to allow informed consent.
Now, part of the Penn Group's defense against this criticism is that it's not research, but that it is training.
Yeah, and in fact, interestingly enough, that's the military's own defense. It appears in that American Psychologist issue where our critique appeared, there's and as along with several others, there's a response by Dr. Seligman to our critique. And he refers there to congressional inquiries that followed our article. So it appears that there were congressional inquiries to the Defense Department around these issues. And he quotes, actually, the Defense Department's response, which is very interesting, because it says correctly that the common rule says that, and DOD regulations say that research is the creation of collection of data for the purpose of creating generalizable knowledge. And so what they then use weasel words to say, nowhere have we stated that the intent of CSF is to create generalizable knowledge. In other words, they don't say that they're not creating generalizable knowledge, which is what's relevant. They simply say we were smart enough never to put it in writing. And then Dr. Seligman's article, the same response to us, goes on to quote various papers that are being prepared for peer-reviewed journals on the CSF program by Defense Department psychologists. So is it research or isn't it research? Well, Dr. Seligman himself bragged to the APA's Monitor on Psychology, quote, this is the largest study, 1.1 million soldiers, psychology has ever been involved in. Well, in my book, I teach research methods. I've taught it for decades. I've been director of research for many organizations. Study and research are synonyms.
Well, I heard him actually talk about how this project, which I certainly took to be research as well as training, was going to allow them, for example, to predict who would be good to promote and who was most likely to commit suicide. And so that kind of prediction to me sounds like, hey, we're doing research here so that we can change things for the future.
Sure, sounds like generalizable knowledge to me.
Yeah.
And so the Defense Department's own rules say that that the soldier should be given the right of informed consent and the right to refuse participation.
You write, quotes, the literature on prevention, this kind of like social engineering, and you write the literature on prevention interventions is full of well-intentioned efforts that either failed to have positive effects or even worse, had harmful consequences for those receiving them. Can you give us an example or two of this?
Yeah, and you know, I've been involved in various prevention efforts as a researcher and evaluator for many years, and this is one of the sobering facts in this area, is that it's not so easy, and that many things that you're totally convinced can only help people don't in fact do so. So one of the most famous, probably the most famous of these is DARE. I'm sure if not our listeners, then the children of many of our listeners have been in the DARE program, the Drug Abuse Resistance Education, which sends DARE officers, police officers, who are specially trained into classrooms in elementary school to do DARE education on how to resist taking up drugs. It sounds well-meaning. Mm-hmm. It's been given across the country to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. It's huge business. And unfortunately, the research on DARE, of which there was fairly extensive, was uniformly negative, that it actually did not prevent drug abuse. In some cases, it might have even had the opposite effect. But its one positive effect is it did improve students' attitudes toward the police, which was not one of the intentions, really. But in terms of substance use, it didn't work. I mean, this is, as someone involved in substance use prevention, this is like something that we all know. Actually, at an APA convention once, I once saw a poster on moderators of DARE. And so I went up to them and I said, oh, my God, have you found that DARE works? Because if you're having moderators of it, then usually that means that it works at least for some people. And they burst out laughing and said, well, we were going to call it yet another boring study showing that DARE doesn't work. But we didn't think that would fly.
Because
there have been so many. And so then DARE got changed in the late 1990s under... First, the DARE folks denied this, and they cited their own not very well-conducted evaluations and said, obviously it works. But after many years and many studies, then they gradually decided, well, it doesn't work. And then they got a major influx of funds to revise it, taking principles from other prevention programs. And then, unfortunately, I actually thought the revision would work, but it turns out the evaluation suggests that it doesn't, that it may actually increase later alcohol and cigarette use in those who receive it. So this is not uncommon.
Yeah, one of the things I guess that we've learned the hard way is, you know, what we might call the rule of unintended consequences.
Yeah.
That when you go after some large, seemingly do-good project, that there will be unintended consequences.
Well, I think it's more complex in prevention than in treatment, because in prevention, the majority, especially primary prevention, the people getting it don't have the problem or disorder that you're trying to prevent. And as opposed to people who are already having problems, where the treatment literature suggests that most treatments are at least moderately effective at reducing whatever problem you're trying to treat. In prevention, it's not so easy.
Yeah. You know, what comes to mind for me, speaking of drugs, is the whole war on drugs and all of the unintended consequences of that, that, you know, seemingly we've built a thriving industry of criminals that in other countries and now in our own country.
Yeah, and the law enforcement and penal industry that also thrive off of this.
Right, right.
And it's unfortunate. And in that case, it's hard to know if it's to what extent it's really unintended, or I'm not saying conspiracy, but I'm saying we've known for so long that the penal approach isn't working, and the fact that it's not changed is not, I don't think, due to political forces that make it hard to change, rather than most people's involvement really thinking that that after 40 years, another 40 years, it's really going to work.
Yeah, you also cite the work of a criminal justice researcher, Joan McCord, who you say has demonstrated how well-meaning programs have caused actual harm. Would that be the DARE program, or is that referring to something else?
No, Joan McCord's a major criminal justice and longitudinal researcher and a very top person. And so she did long-term follow-up, a 30-year follow-up of a classic delinquency prevention project. This was a randomized project where participants were randomly selected for intervention or to be in a control group. Those in the intervention were given extensive enrichment. They were given mentoring, counseling, summer camp, you know, all good things. These were from an inner city population. And what she found from her evaluation 30 years later was absolutely startling. First of all, it's important to remember that the participants were almost to a man very positive on the program and when recalled it fondly said how important it had been to their lives. But when she looked at the actual quantitative data comparing the two groups, she found that those who got the intensive assistance were more likely to have been convicted of serious street crimes, were more likely given diagnoses of alcoholism, schizophrenia, or manic depression, and this is the real disturbing, on average died 5 years younger. So here we've got a program that sounds wonderful, that people at the time thought wonderful, that the participants 30 years later thought was wonderful, and yet they're dying 5 years younger.
Wow.
So she followed this up with looking at several other programs and found similar results in some of them. What she thinks is going on had to do partially with the summer camp. And what that basically getting delinquents or pre-delinquents together in groups may not be a good strategy, because these can be boot camps teaching you all the latest techniques on how to be a better delinquent. And that while group treatment and group approaches sound good to us, they may in fact be counterproductive.
Okay. Now, coming back to CSF, you say that the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program is adapted primarily from the Penn Resiliency Program, PRP, where interventions were focused on dramatically different non-military populations. How so?
Well, first, the populations were originally was middle school students. I remember one of the early studies, and it was impressive. It was one of few prevention studies where there seemed to be effects that lasted more than a few months after the intervention. That's another one of the unfortunate things about most prevention things. They don't last very long when they do have positive effects. But when I looked up their own, this is the Penn's own meta-analysis. Meta-analysis, for those who don't know, is a way of combining multiple studies to try and get a fairly accurate quantitative measure across studies and all their individual variability of how well an intervention works. So the Penn group did a meta-analysis of 17 controlled studies of their resiliency program. And from this is their own analysis that's cited in that American Psychologist article as the main evidence for it. And what I found when I read it carefully is that their own analysis showed it was only modestly and inconsistently effective. It produced small reductions in mild self-reported depressive symptoms, but it only did so in those who were already at high risk for depression. In other words, not the general population. In terms of prevention, there's one strategy is the primary prevention where you try and target everybody, which is what CSF is doing. Another is where you only target those at high risk. And what the Penn's own analysis showed was that the resiliency program was only effective for those who were already at high risk, not for the general population. And as I said, the effects were modest. And it didn't have any greater effect than other prevention programs that it was compared to. The effects were no larger. This is relevant to their getting in that no-bid contract, which raised questions whether the effects had anything to do with the resilience theory. After all, the other prevention programs weren't based on this resilience model, and they had the same effects. Further, and also relevant to CSF, that had better outcomes when it was administered by highly trained research staff than when given by staff recruited from the community, because CSF is not going to be administered by research staff, but by these master resilience trainers, sergeants, who are more akin to people from the community.
Yeah, so you suggest that it's really a stretch to think that that program would be generalizable to the challenges and experiences that routinely face our soldiers in combat, including those that regularly trigger PTSD.
A far stretch. I mean, there was the program was mainly with like middle school students, some high school students, and one or two adult groups. So I say dealing with preventing mostly mild anxiety and depression. PTSD is an altogether different ball game, and so the relevance of that data, if this was presented to an IRB, people would say, you got to be kidding. So it might have authorized a small pilot study, but no way to say, well, good, we've got good enough data to go rushing in the field and doing this for a million soldiers.
You fault that special issue of the American Psychologist, which was all about the soldier training, for failing to discuss ethical concerns, such as, I think we've touched on some, but...
Yeah, we've talked about the informed consent concerns, which is a major one.
Yeah.
There.
No ethics and, review committees. That was
No ethics review committees, no informed consent, which should be remembered is an American military principle. After World War II, the U.S. military put on trial various Nazi leaders, including the so-called doctors' trial, where doctors who'd done horrific things in the concentration camps were put on trial. In order to create, sort of after-the-fact creation of law, as part of that trial, they created the Nuremberg Code as a binding code for all biomedical research. The Nuremberg Code, created by our military and used to try and convict doctors in Germany, begins by saying the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. That is the fundamental principle of research as asserted by our military. So it's not just some little regulation there. People were tried and convicted under this. So we're concerned, to touch on what we were talking about just a moment ago, the uncertain effects of CSF. The only ethical issue raised in that article is whether it might be unethical to refuse or withhold CSF from some soldiers to do a randomized trial. And they argue that that wouldn't be ethical because CSF is so effective, as we know. Sorry for my sarcasm there. But I just found that argument amazing.
Yeah. You raised the question of whether the training might actually cause harm, which we've hinted at before.
Yeah, I mean,
you say soldiers who've been trained to be resilient might view combat as a growth opportunity and be more likely to ignore or underestimate real dangers, thereby placing themselves, their comrades, or civilians at heightened risk of harm.
Yeah, I mean, one can imagine many mechanisms that might lead to harm, and I'm sure there are others possibilities that we can't imagine. I mean, as Joan McCord, no one had thought of that, as far as I'm aware. So that's one possibility, is that people who are, you know, trained to view situations more positively may actually not realistically assess real risks. We know that teenagers routinely downplay real risks, as in driving at incredible speeds or driving while drunk, and we certainly don't want our soldiers ignoring real risks. Now, will CSF cause that? I don't know. But the point is, neither do they. We're not asserting that it will do these things. We're saying that it needs to be known and should be known before this is rolled out.
Well, I know when I heard it presented at that conference, I had a mixed reaction myself. On the one hand, I was impressed by the scope and the command and, in a sense, the vision that was being described here. I thought was pretty impressive to be able to mount something on this scale. And on the other hand, I felt a kind of niggling concern that there was a dark underbelly here, which I was not able to articulate for myself or my listeners in the detailed way that you guys have done in your article. But I just had this sort of feeling like, well, do we want a sort of a robotic army that feels okay about killing? Like, there are some things maybe that should induce trauma.
Exactly. If you want a moral army, and at least some elements in the military definitely do, and I think as a democracy we should have, you want soldiers who are aware of the complex ethical situations in which they're placed. Killing is not something that should ever come very easy. And we know that a lot of military training, basic training, is about dehumanizing the enemy so that you can kill them, because it turns out that it's not so easy to get soldiers to kill. But we never want people to be so resilient that they're not bothered by it. And we never want them to not ask questions of themselves and others when civilians or other innocents are killed or wounded. And we never want them to stop questioning. To stop questioning is very dangerous, and it's to dehumanize them.
You know, earlier you said that you made kind of passing reference to a $31 million no-bid contract. What's the significance? What are the issues about a no-bid contract here?
Well, first, this is unusual, to put it mildly. You know, federal regulations usually require bidding on almost everything. You know, to have a $50,000 no-bid contract is extremely difficult for the government to do. $31 million is something out of the ballpark.
They're not inviting competitive bidding.
Yes.
They're just saying, we're going to give $31 million to this one person.
Yeah, what they said was, there is no one else who can do this work. And they cited two arguments, one of which was the empirical basis for CSF based in the Penn Resiliency program. Now, as we just talked about a few minutes ago, that empirical basis is very weak, and there's no evidence it's more effective than other prevention programs, of which there are several. So there are other options. And in fact, the General Cornum, who issued this contract, had previously talked about other prevention programs to military people. So she was well aware that there were alternatives. So the second reason they gave was that CSF was the only one allegedly that had a training of trainers model. There's some validity to this, but training of trainers is a standard step in the development of many prevention programs, and it would not have been a lengthy process for others, preventionists, to have developed that part of it. So they saved a little bit of time, perhaps, but as we discussed, the training of trainers wasn't very effective. When they trained the community people, the program was less effective. So it's not as if they had a well-functioning and successful training of trainers. So those are the two things that were given as the reason why nobody else was even allowed to submit a bid on this. Now, see, here's the background. And the background, which Mark Benjamin, then at Salon, had talked about, and others have talked about, I played a bit part in this a long time ago. Dr. Seligman was discovered to have, well, let me back up a little bit. The CIA's, I will call it, because I believe it is, torture program that was based on Dr. Seligman's learned helplessness principles. We know this now from the Justice Department torture memos, which explicitly state how this program is based on learned helplessness theory. So therefore, it's eventually, and this learned helplessness was implemented using techniques from the military SEER program, the Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, where U.S. soldiers who are likely to be captured by a power that does not respect the Geneva Conventions, unquote, by which they mean a torturing power, are given training whereby they're submitted to a very brief period of essentially torture by trainers with the idea of inoculating them from breaking down should they be captured.
Mm-hmm.
And so the SEER program was reverse engineered by CIA contract psychologists into the torture program that they used, and involving learned helplessness principles. So therefore, New Yorker reporter Jane Mayer reported in her book, The Dark Side, that Dr. Seligman had spoken to the SEER trainers in March of 2002, when this program was being developed, arranged by the CIA, not by the military, but by the CIA, in particular the CIA psychologist who was in charge of, who was the contract officer for the torture program. And so questions were raised, well, Dr. Sullivan, what were you doing there? And he issued one of these apparently lawyer-written statements saying, basically, I didn't know it would be used for the torture program because they told me they couldn't discuss interrogation uses because I didn't have security clearance. So, you know, people then think, well, they told you it wouldn't be, they couldn't discuss interrogation uses. Doesn't that suggest that it had interrogation uses that they were interested in? If they're telling you that they can't discuss it. And we also know that the two top CIA contract psychologists who designed this program, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, were in the audience. So there's been suspicion about Dr. Sullivan's involvement in this, and gradually we've learned that he had several other meetings with Mitchell and Jessen, and James Mitchell had praised learned helplessness to Dr. Sullivan. And so there's a suspicion among some that this no-bid contract could have been, in some sense, a payback for his help in this other program.
I see.
And so that's, you know, that's something that we feel needs to be investigated.
Right.
And so that's what the issue is there. It's very odd, to say the least, that this a $31 million thing would be issued as a no-bid contract. The arguments for having to be no bid are rather weak, to say the least. And there's this other involvement, which is concerning.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I can't make any direct accusations. I can say if there's evidence that suggests an investigation is warranted.
Right, right. One of the things that come out of the positive psychology research is the suggestion that people who have strong spiritual orientation, people who are religious, enjoy better health, longer life, I think, more success, generally longer marriages. If questions have been raised about the appropriateness of the spiritual fitness, which I think would refer to that body of research, that there's a spiritual fitness component of the CSF program. And you raised some questions about that.
Yeah, well, first on the connection, as of my reading, which I admit is a few years old at this point, actually the main connection between religion and those good health consequences appears to be more due to religious practice, namely going to church and being part of a community, than to spiritual belief.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's important to keep in mind that it's not necessarily the case that spiritual belief that's the major factor there. But putting that aside, so one of the there's a test that goes with the CSF that all soldiers are required to take, and one part of it has a spiritual fitness component, and then there are recommendations if you're low for improving your spiritual fitness as there are for the other forms of fitness. And this has been challenged by a number of soldiers with a secular or atheist orientation who feel that this is promoting of religion by the military, and something which has been problematic in various places. There's been reports of major involvement of evangelical Christians on the faculty at the Air Force Academy, for example. And so they have objected strenuously to the spiritual fitness being part of this, and to being a required test, and to getting recommendations on how to improve it. And Jason Leopold, a Truth Out reporter, has written on this several times.
One point in the article that resonated with me because of my longtime affiliation with humanistic psychology and the fact that that positive psychology has given scant credit to to the pioneering work of humanistic psychologists. You write, in important ways, key lessons of humanistic psychology are also regrettably overlooked in the CSF program. Yeah, say a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, humanistic psychology has emphasized the roles of personal responsibility and the creation of meaning by people and how we're all responsible for creating that meaning. And that there are profound questions that we cannot evade about the meaning of life and its worth. And these are obviously amplified by soldiers who are dealing with questions of life and death on a daily basis, of in good cases of right and wrong. We've recently seen the instance of the urinating on the dead bodies of the Taliban. There have been many instances of soldiers who were deeply, deeply traumatized and by participation in torture or detainee abuse. And we think that any reasonable program would help soldiers deal with these conflicts, to explore them, to become aware of them, to realize, to confront these existential dilemmas that they're faced with, rather than to paper them over, with sort of the worst of positive psychology, because I think positive psychology has had some good effects and some kind of simplistic pop psychology views as well.
Well, there are a lot more very specific points that you make in your article that we're not going to have time to go through them all, but I will be putting a link to the article in my show notes so that listeners can go and look at read the article for themselves, which I hope that they will do. You mentioned that there have been, that you printed your article in a shortened version of the article in the APA journal. So I have two questions related to that. First of all, before you printed your article, or maybe it came out in the same issue, I'm wondering, how did other people react to that 13 article issue of the APA that seemed to be such a cheerleading thing for the CSF program?
Well, it was about 7 or 8 months later that the commentaries appeared, as usually happens. It's hard to know. I mean, I was struck at one level by the lack of response. I mean, this was such a jingoistic promotional piece. I'd expected more outrage, but I find no sign that anyone on the APA's Council of Representatives, for example, raised any questions about why was American Psychologist publishing such an uncritical set of pieces. But on the other hand, when the comments came, there were about 5 comments, all of which were extremely critical, some of which echoed some of our points, and there were certainly were other points raised. So among those who wrote, there was a fairly critical reception, and others have chimed in as well. Noted experts on trauma, such as Bessel van der Kolk, for example, has been very critical of the CSF program, as arguing that it's not likely to be effective at helping soldiers prevent or deal with trauma, based on his extensive work on PTSD over the decades. So there's been much critique of it, many people questioning various parts of it, but not as much direct response to the APA's promotional role in this.
How about reactions to your articles in Truth Out and other places, as well as in the American Psychologist?
Well, we were pleased. We got a lot of response. We got response from veterans groups who thanked us for it. Scientific American had a blog piece praising it, as did some other scientific publications. So it was a very wide range of response, and we've been in touch with military people, including some former military mental health people who share our basic sentiments that this is rather, this program was outrageous, was rushed into the field, and should not have been treated in that kind of way, and that major questions were ignored. So we've gotten a lot of responses. As I said, it looks like Congress took this up. I've been trying to find out who in Congress this was and to get the questions from Congress and the Defense Department response to this.
I take it there were no threatened lawsuits or anything to dissuade you from continuing along this line?
No.
That's good.
But as you know, I've been a critic of issues. I think people don't think I'm going to intimidate easily.
Yeah.
And one downside about threatening lawsuits is then you open yourself up to being deposed under oath.
Yeah. So what about the relationship of APA to the military? APA is perhaps the largest professional association on the earth, I think I heard at one point.
Yeah.
And
Mental Health Professional Association.
Okay. And, you know, if the APA were to be co-opted by government or the military, that would be a very bad thing. How do you see that relationship?
Well,
what should it be?
Well, I would say it has been. I mean, one of the sort of underreported aspects of professional psychology in the U.S. is that the ties to the military go way back to World War I, where psychologists helped in selection of troops, and again in World War II, where psychologists helped in that. They helped with so-called shell shock, or the antecedent of PTSD. They help in human factors engineering of tanks and bombers. And it's not by accident that the first psychology license in the United States issued by a state was in 1946, essentially payback for the role psychology played in the war effort. And psychology has always had a relatively unique role in the military because, as I'm sure you know, there's been turf battles and status battles between psychology and psychiatry going back many, many, many years.
Sure.
But the military is one place where psychology has tended to be dominant. Psychiatrists have had a fairly limited role there, and psychologists have had a much wider role. And, for example, in the military's interrogation program at Guantanamo and elsewhere, the psychiatrists took a position that their members should not participate. Some did, but the association repudiated this. The psychologists took a role that psychologists have a vital role to play in keeping interrogations allegedly safe, legal, ethical, and effective, and promoted the role of psychologists over and over again, ignoring or downplaying the extensive and evidence that psychologists were not preventing abuse. Psychologists were the ones who created the abuse and were perpetrating it. So the APA, you know, never took a position critical of U.S. government policies there. They kept on manipulating the position so that they could avoid that. They brag when you read their work. They have extremely close ties with the military and intelligence communities on a regular basis that are disturbing. Now, I'm not saying they should have no contact, but I think that all these ties should be open. They should be openly discussed. So, for example, the American Anthropological Association had a task force look at the working with the military and intelligence agencies. It included people who do work with them and included strong critics of this. They met for a year, carefully considered, and took a position that was a compromise. It didn't say that anthropologists can't work with the military, but it did say that they should not work in classified settings because this is contrary to the ethics of anthropology and the responsibility to the people studied. But they also said that it was the responsibility of anthropologists to clarify the ethical issues and the boundaries beyond which they won't go at the beginning of their work. Because if you don't do it at the beginning, the ethical, you get a blurring of ethical boundaries is almost inevitably occurs in these types of activities. In contrast, the American Psychological Association, when they created a task force to look at involvement of psychologists in interrogations after the abuses at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and the CIA were public, they appointed a majority of military intelligence psychologists, many of whom had been involved in chains of command that had been reported to be participating in abuses. They appointed no critics to the committee. They met for one weekend, and then they rushed the report out within a couple of days of the ending of that weekend, with no opportunity for independent review by the membership, the Council of Representatives. They hid the membership of that committee as long as they could. And they have, as far as I know, held no workshops for researchers on the complex ethical issues that occur when you work with the military or intelligence agencies, such as the complexities of classified research where you don't know to what your uses your work will be put. You know, if they really were concerned about ethics, they would do what they could, even if they thought that one should participate in this research, they would try and clarify the issues, try and alert people to the complexities involved, rather than just bragging about getting this intelligence contract and that military contract.
Well, you're no stranger to the role of APA Gadfly. In fact, you're past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. What can you tell us about that group?
Well, CSR, as you know, Psychologists for Social Responsibility, CSR was founded in the 1980s as part of the nuclear freeze movement, and has gradually, originally was focused on preventing nuclear war, has gradually expanded its focus to a wide range of peace, social justice, and environmental sustainability issues, with the rise of a movement to remove psychologists from abusive interrogations and torture. That gave, I think, a new energy to CSR, and I think today some of the Occupy movements and the anti-poverty efforts are also invigorating our efforts. We're a fairly small organization. We certainly welcome membership. CSR, PSYSR.org is our website. We'd love to have people join. And by the way, you can get a malpractice insurance discount through us. So,
is there any official affiliation with the APA?
No. We're independent of the APA. We do work with some APA divisions, and we're open to collaborating with APA where it's appropriate, but we also act as critic where we think we should.
Okay. Well, as we wind down now, is there anything that you'd like to add?
I would say that both the interrogations torture issue and the CSF program raise very profound questions for the profession of psychology. So what type of profession we're going to be? Are we going to be people who will serve whoever's the most powerful or has the most money? Or are we going to be a profession with its independent professional ethics, which based on the do no harm ethic that says that our primary responsibility is to help people and not hurt them. And so I'm hoping that not just these issues alone, but that it'll start opening up a broader discussion in the profession and the wider public, because we only get the benefits of a profession because the public thinks we should, as to what psychology is going to be. And I hope we'll get a stronger return to and commitment to the do-no-harm ethic.
Well, I certainly appreciate your courageous work and encourage you to keep at it. You're an important voice for our profession. So, Dr. Stephen Saltz, thanks for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
I hope you enjoyed and were challenged by this conversation with Dr. Stephen Saltz. I must say, he certainly breaks the stereotype that many people have of the psychoanalyst as a passive, blank screen type of person. Clearly, he's a passionate and courageous political activist. Longtime listeners will know that I've been following developments in positive psychology for some time, even offering a CEU course on our website devoted to that topic. I've been a bit of a camp follower. Initially, I was very ambivalent about Dr. Martin Seligman, especially because he never seemed to acknowledge the earlier important work of humanistic psychology. I also was a little put out because he turned down my request for an interview on two or three occasions. However, I must admit I was both impressed and charmed by him at the International Positive Psychology Conference I attended in Philadelphia this past summer. And I especially appreciated his permission to play his keynote address here on the site. As you heard me say here, I had mixed emotions to the presentation I heard him give about the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program. On the one hand, I was impressed by the scope of his vision and his ability to get attention and funds from high places. On the other hand, I definitely sensed a potential dark side. However, Dr. Soltz and his co-authors in their article spelled out in exquisite detail the concerns that for me were only a vague stirring. So I really urge you to read their article, which you will find if you do a Google search on the dark side of soldier fitness. And you can expect that I'll have Dr. Soltz back on the show in the future to balance out our view of what's going on in psychology, because as good Jungians, we know the shadow is never far away.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hello, everyone. My goodness, it feels like it's been a long time since I've spoken with you. Some of these recent interviews have just been so juicy that I've let them run long, and there hasn't been much time left for announcements and letters and such. And today is no exception. Well, if we run long, we run long. First, I want to call your attention to a new donor category, which I've named the Ultra Colossal Donor Level, of $35 a month for 12 months, thanks to a listener in the Bahamas who has asked me not to use his name, but give some hints so that his friends may recognize him. He did his graduate work at Capella University and hoped to bring them on as a shrink wrap radio sponsor. Although that hasn't happened, he really appreciates the education he's receiving there and has received there, and will appreciate the mention of Capella University, so I'm mentioning it. And he's now working as a licensed professional counselor at Ross University in Freeport, Grand Bahama, and he's an avid cyclist. So, mystery donor, I thank you for your "Can You Top This Challenge" to other listeners and your enthusiasm for Shrink Wrap Radio. And while I'm acknowledging our top contributors, I don't want to forget to mention super colossal donors, Katie Morrison of Morrison Mentoring in Melbourne, and Peter Myron, from whom I'll read an email in our listener letters section. So thanks to these pace setters and everyone else who's clicked on the big green donate button at the top of the Shrink Wrap Radio page. Your support means so much to me. I want to alert you to my latest interview on my other podcast series at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an interview with Gerti Schoen on the gentle self. We talk about her book, The Gentle Self, How to Overcome Your Difficulties with Depression, Anxiety, Shyness, and Low Self-Esteem. She started her career as a journalist in Germany, which brought her to the United States as a foreign correspondent. Inspired by the dynamic energy of New York City, she decided to change careers and became a psychotherapist, a psychoanalyst, in fact, and at the same time, a Zen practitioner. She focuses on the study of Heinz Kohut's theory of narcissism and self-psychology in her psychoanalytic practice. So I think you'll find this an intellectually juicy interview. You know, speaking of wise counsel, I just discovered that I've conducted something like 105 interviews on that site. That means that between the two shows, I've done more than 400 interviews. Whew! How did that happen? Now, speaking of juicy interviews, a number of new transcripts have been added to our site thanks to some very industrious volunteers. Charlie Bathgate transcribed number 288, The Buddha Occupies Wall Street, with Michael Stone. Remember that one? Plus, Dale Hoff transcribed three episodes. First, number 11, The Use of Metaphor and Story in Market Research. Number 12, Altered States of Consciousness, in which Adam Ronskevich interviewed me. And number 13, Jungian Archetypes and Their Application in Psychotherapy and Consumer Research. So Dale Hoff really went back in time and reclaimed some of those past episodes to make them more available to us all. And Holly Ambrose, I need to thank for transcribing Shrink Wrap Radio number 286, Understanding Jungian Active Imagination, with Dr. Monica Wickman. Thank you all for your hard work on these valuable transcriptions. And if anyone else out there would like to become a transcriber, please let me know. Let me remind you to make all your Amazon.com purchases through the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. Not just the books you hear mentioned here, but also any other items you might be purchasing from Amazon. And I believe they are now shipping internationally. By the way, you'll see some featured books in that right-hand sidebar as well. And these are books by authors interviewed on either Shrink Wrap Radio or Wise Counsel. And clicking on the cover icon that you'll find there in the right-hand sidebar will take you directly to that book on Amazon. I hope you'll patronize these authors who have decided to contribute a bit of advertising support in the wake of their interviews. I mentioned previously that listener Irina Almgren is also a podcaster out of Sweden, a very fine podcaster, I might add, and part three of her interview with me on DreamWork is now available on her podcast site in iTunes. You can find it by going to the Open Questions podcast in iTunes or by Googling it. In addition, Irina is working with me to try to set up a weekend dream workshop in either Stockholm or Uppsala, and we're currently looking at June as a possibility. In addition, as a result of her encouragement, I'm also thinking about offering a series of webinars on dream work. I'm thinking of starting out with one on Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey, outlining the steps of the journey and illustrating them with selected tarot cards and Hollywood film clips. Does this sound like something you might be interested in? If so, let me know. I'm also thinking of offering a webinar to you on the Hollywood film A Dangerous Method, which I finally was able to see. Now, I've spoken to Jungian analysts Monica Wickman and John Beebe about possibly participating, both of whom you've heard on prior podcasts here. For anyone living in the San Francisco Bay Area, John asked me to mention or to announce the program on A Dangerous Method through the San Francisco Jung Institute on March 11th. Coming up very soon. I think it's a Sunday, and it will feature John Beebe discussing the film with Tom Kirsch, a past president of the International Association for Analytical Psychology, Virginia Rutter, a Jungian analyst who's an expert on female initiation, and Peter Carnican, a psychoanalyst who has written about the ethical dimension of psychoanalysis. If you'd like to attend, it will be held in San Francisco on March 11th from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. So if you live in the area and you'd like to attend, contact the San Francisco Jung Institute right away. I plan to be there, so keep your eye out for me if you do go and say hello. Also, I'm currently trying to finish up a piece on the film A Dangerous Method for my Psychology Today blog. I'm hearing good reports about our iPhone and Android shrink wrap radio apps, even from folks outside the United States. So if you haven't got the app for your smartphone yet, just go to shrinkwrapradio.com and click on the Apps tab at the top of the page for instructions. Finally, I just wanted to share with you that my adult son, Jonathan, and I were able to see a concert with Joan Baez and Marianne Aya Omack in a small theater nearby. They were so wonderful that both Jonathan and I choked up with tears. We both thought that the concert was transcendent. I feel like Joan Baez has provided much of the soundtrack of my life, and it was a real thrill to see her in such an intimate setting and also to share her with my son. And Marianne Aya Omack is an amazing performer in her own right and may be familiar to European listeners. She was certainly new to me. She's French and sings not only in French but also Spanish and English. And there's a wonderful CD featuring both women on iTunes, and I also imagine you could purchase it on Amazon using the widget on Shrink Wrap Radio. The album title is Marianne Aya Omack Solo, which is ironic given that there are several duets with Baez on it. Okay, enough. On to some listener emails.
Hi, this is Jungian therapist and workshop leader, Dr. Richard Nagel. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Richard Nagel, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. First, we hear from our newest super colossal donor, Peter Myron, who writes, "Hi, David. I've been wanting for some time to increase my support level, and then recently I noticed that my previous subscription of $10 a month had expired in September. I'm so happy to lend you my support. As you once joked, you deserve a raise for the high-quality service you provide. So here is a small piece of that raise. Your shows, Wise Counsel 2, is one of the bright points in my life. I have learned so much from your guests over the 3 years that I've been a listener. My contribution hardly pays you back for my gain. I have written you before explaining that I am in individual and group therapy. I feel your show directly supports and encourages my personal growth process in a number of ways. In particular, I see that it enhances what the Buddhists call right view. Very often I'm inspired to learn more about a therapy or an idea discussed by you and a guest, and I'm off on another journey of discovery, all of which helps me develop a healthy perspective and a more comprehensive view of my own self and process. I would love to hear more shows on marriage counseling or perhaps personal growth within the context of a primary relationship. Two people I would encourage that you check out are Bruce Tift, who's just come out with an excellent book, already free, Buddhism Meets Psychotherapy, and David Schnarch, author of Passionate Marriage, and he provides some links here. On a personal note, spending as much time with you as I do, hours of dog walking time each week, I feel as though I can consider you a personal friend. Your warmth and humanity shines through each episode. I have a Sebastopol, California connection. My brother and sister-in-law live on the outskirts, so I nurture a private fantasy of meeting you for a coffee some visit. I don't know about an on-show shout-out for me, but I'm going to explore the possibility of you mentioning a men's organization I belong to in Chicago. It is a wonderful organization that offers personal growth weekend programs and fosters the establishment of small men's group circles. I've been a thriving member for 5+ years and see the great good it does enriching men's lives. In the interest of due diligence, I feel the need to clear this with the organization first. Please keep up the good work, David, your friend, Pete. Well, Pete, thanks so much for your super colossal donation subscription, and I'm so glad you came back after your $10 a month subscription expired. Unfortunately, PayPal doesn't send me any sort of message letting me know when people's subscriptions run out, so I'm really glad that you were monitoring it and even stepped it up so significantly. Well, I have given you a shout-out, and I hope you're not too embarrassed by the fact. I'll be happy to give a shout-out for your men's organization once you get clearance from them. I've taken note of your guest requests on shows on marriage, and if you haven't heard my interview with Stan Tatkin, I'd especially recommend him on that topic as well. And the next time you visit your brother and sister-in-law in Sebastopol, do let me know, and we'll have that cup of coffee together. I'm looking forward to it.
Hey, Dr. Dave, it's Brandon calling from Christchurch, New Zealand. I'm actually using your app to give you a call and want to let you know that it's an awesome app and it works well. And what I like about it is I can call you through it or I can email you and download and keep all my favorite interviews, actually. You've got some really cool ones that I really like. And I don't wish to delete them once I have them and listen to them over and over again. But here in Christchurch, great day. We're still recovering from the multiple quakes that we had. We had one on the 23rd of September, and I'm currently unemployed because of the quake. I am going for a job interview in a couple of days, and hopefully things go well, and I'm pretty confident that I'll get this job. And, so I hope you're doing well and keep up the good work. Thanks, mate. Bye.
Hey, Brandon, thanks for that voicemail. I'm sorry to hear that you're still feeling aftershocks from that big quake and that it's disrupted the economy and job opportunities. I sure hope you got that job that you were going for. And I really appreciate your getting the app. I don't know whether you're on an iPhone or an Android, but I was impressed by the sound quality of your message. How cool. Good luck to you, mate, and keep your chin up. So in the interest of time, I think I'd better wrap it up here. So you can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Or you can use your smartphone with our app, just as you heard Brandon do. Thanks to Dr. Stephen Soltz for alerting us to the dark side of the Soldier Fitness Program. And I look forward to future interviews with Dr. Soltz exposing us to the political shenanigans within our profession. My next episode will feature an interview with yet another Jungian, Dr. Richard Nagel, whom I've come to know through a local Jungian discussion group I've been involved in. This is a live interview in his home, and I think you'll enjoy it. We'll be focusing on mythology and the spiritual journey. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.